Oh, hey there. I'm Guy Brandon, and welcome to Pop Rocket, a weekly show picking over all the pop culture we love to love. With me to talk TV, film, music, and anything else entertaining are journalist and novelist Margaret Wappler.
Hey there, Guy. I love it when you use your NPR voice.
I hate it. Like, I have always felt that there's something deeply oppressive about NPR voice, about how it is, like, over it normative. Like, it is, like, deeply committed to people not being emotionally invested in things, and you know I love emotional investment in things.
Yeah, it's all about the emotional distance.
Yeah.
Even over sweaty balls.
I do love when what's-her-name with the bad Philly accent, Terry Gross, talks to... like rappers, because she always takes such a tone of, and we all know that when you left the Wu-Tang Clan, like, she just feels so committed to that. And we have pop culture scholar and dyke about town, Karen Tongson.
Hi, Guy. Hey, Rocketeers.
Karen, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. My voice is recovered for this week.
And just a quick note on mine and Karen's gender expression. today it has reached one of those magical overlap points of efficient queer shorts.
Yes.
Efficient
queer shorts, although I'm wearing very dour, like, Converse sweat shorts.
You're kind of like half gym rat, half goth.
I'm doing goth gym rat. Like, it's so Southern California. And Guy has beautiful, like, cerulean blue shorts from Ralph Lauren, I'm assuming.
I just really feel like with the headset on, it seems like you might be working tech for something.
Totes.
Or
I aspire to be, like, you know, second camera.
Can you get my levels real quick?
On a CISO show, yeah.
Oh, God. Almost RIP CISO, you guys. Okay, coming up on this week's show, the Pop Rocket Summer Book Club will be discussing Octavia Butler's Parable of the Sower. Plus, we'll each be sharing our latest jams. But first, let's find out what arts and entertainment news or events have caught our attention this week. Margaret Wappler, what are you all about this week?
I'm all about, once again, I know I was about it a few weeks ago, but I can't not talk about this episode.
Because no one else will talk about it.
Twin Peaks, Episode 8, Last Night. Holy shit. This definitely launched as far as this series so far has allowed itself to go into just complete dream logic and experimental art film. There was barely any kind of narrative really hanging it all together. Although people are knocking themselves out silly on the internet trying to figure out if the convenience store that you see at one point is a reference to the convenience store in Fire Walk With Me. And you know, as far as I'm concerned, all those kinds of, you know, Easter egg hunting it's fun, but it's not what I'm after when I watch the show. I really am just into how amazingly febrile his mind is with visual language at this point. Like, I mean, you see everything is referenced from, like, you know, the Manhattan Projects to some sort of scary frog locust creature that crawls into a woman's mouth to, like, charred hobos who inflict murder. I mean, it's astounding.
In the 90s, was this a co-watch with family?
Oh, hell no.
Oh, okay.
Nobody from my family wanted anything to do with that.
All right.
But I now watch the show with a group of friends, and it's interesting because I do think this show lends itself to group watching and group solving. Like, every time there's an episode, I love going online and seeing what people are saying about it, more than most shows.
Yeah.
It's interesting that something that has such an experimental feel and look could be group watch amenable, though, you know?
It is.
It's sort of, like, I can't imagine being huddled around with a bunch of people watching Inland Empire by David Lynch. You know what I mean? Have that same kind of feel? I think you mentioned that last time you talked about the show.
It does have a similar vibe to Inland Empire, although I would say that right now it's really hitting more of the Eraserhead feeling and more of David Lynch's early experimental films. And there's just this desire I think people have to collect on the internet and basically go to each other, what does it mean?
Yeah. So, like, do you want a solvable Twin Peaks, or do you want Twin Peaks to wash over you?
I want it to wash over me. And in fact, I was talking with friends last night and I said, what is the central question of this particular season? Because last time it was, who killed Laura Palmer? Well, that's already been answered. And this time it's a much more kind of evasive, foggy question. It's much more sort of like, well, when is good Dale Cooper going to get back into this plane of reality? Which is not the same type of question. So to me, like, that's another reason why I'm not that particularly concerned with, like, everything linking up and everything lacing together and some sort of perfectly solvable jigsaw puzzle. I actually like the fact that I think there's going to be quite a few strands that are just left dangling.
Ms. Tongson. I'm Dr. Tongson. What the fuck am I doing?
Ms. Dr. Tongson.
Ms. Dr. Tongson.
What Frau you Dr. Tongson. I'm about to go to Germany, so I've got to get used to it.
What are you all about?
I am all about, as maybe many of you are, the new Ken dolls recently released by Mattel. And in particular, Autostraddle's response to it, which was to make a kind of definitive list of 75 lesbian Ken dolls ranked by lesbianism. Because, you know, when those first images of the new Ken dolls were released, people were sort of like, whoa, like they are looking pretty, I don't know, maybe mask genderqueer, like fashionable. They're very multi-culti and svelte. There's a man bun on one of them. Is it a man bun or is it a they bun? Who knows? And the Autostraddle piece really nailed it by kind of establishing all of the different lesbian types that could be mapped onto Ken dolls through the ages, really. And so among the ones that were my favorite from the list of 75 include Art Director Ken, which was number 49, Earring Magic Ken.
Okay, you have to step back and you have to teach the children about Earring Magic Ken, Karen.
Well, Earring Magic Ken has like kind of an amazing swept back, I would say body wave, but comb flat do with like a single earring. Like think, you know, George Michael in Wake Me Up Before You Go-Go.
And came out like 89 or 91 or
exactly.
Something like that. When it, like a queer community that had been rocked by HIV had just gotten its shit together enough to be able to reclaim something. Just one thing. And Earring Magic Ken, popularly known as Cochrane Ken.
Cochrane Ken, exactly.
Because he was wearing a thing around his neck that was a like, cock ring.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
Where were the anal beads is my question.
I think that was saved for like Cali Surfer Ken or whatever. but yeah, like, no, that's the thing that this Autostraddle piece was really genius about is it, you know, what it took was this contemporary phenomenon and like the kind of internet buzz about or the social media buzz about how these characters looked queer, the new ones, and contextualized it for us historically that Ken was always already some iteration of a kind of alternate sexuality and gender expression.
I would like...
Was he the first metrosexual?
Well, oh, yeah, totally.
I think it's so interesting because Ken is for pre-sexual girls, so they can only like he is without genitals and he has to be the things that are pretty about being a man, and when you do all of that you're into something that is a lot closer to
CKB.
What is CKB?
CK1 and CKB.
Yes.
Those two gender neutral fragrances from the early 90s,
or like soft butch lesbians of today.
Absolutely.
You know,
Distressed Denim Ken, who's number 3, by the way, looks like all of my friends.
So,
if you want to see them at Smog Cutter, for instance.
Exactly.
How do you feel about the gender policing of the man bun generally and then as applied to the man bun Ken?
I think that the gender policing of the man bun generally is completely justified if facial hair is part of it.
Uh-huh.
Like, because it's like there's nothing more odious than the man bun, like kind of scraggly hippie beard combo. And the thing is, the man bun thing or the tiny pony was like an invention, I believe, of, you know, kind of early 90s lesbians who weren't quite committed to cutting their hair off. Maybe they were still playing soccer or softball, like in college. And so, I mean, I do, you know, I acknowledge its importance as a kind of transitional mode. But like the man bun in its contemporary iteration is so much about like signifying cis male wokeness.
Yes.
Although I like the man bun because then you can always tell who's holding in your area. And who's got CBD at least.
Oh, totally. You know who's got. It's like CBD oils. Like it's all of like, you know, the CBD like balms.
And I think I have way, if we're going to talk like different scraggly hairstyles, I have way more ire for the soul patch than I do have for the man bun.
Well, it's so interesting because we've journeyed to a point when like, you know, we at our age have gotten to watch the soul patch on its journey of the past 20 years.
And quite a journey it's been.
Interesting.
A stone temple journey.
To think about, will the man bun... Oh, Karen, there's that good German word for when culture trickles down. Do you know it at all?
Gosh, I don't... I mean...
It's a very complex word, but it's basically the way that, like, something goes from being a court dance to a folk dance. And you have, like, that so frequently... Basically, my question is this. Do you think the man bun will make it down to blue-collar America enough that in the way we see soul patches primarily when we are going to Disneyland or Las Vegas and have to sort of, like, hang out with people from, like, Alabama, will...
Yes. I think it already has trickled.
It already has.
Okay.
I think that it's already on Deadliest Catch, frankly. I mean, I'm not sure, but I'm assuming that it's like there in that same kind of like Duck Dynasty world that there's going to be a man bun.
And like students in the grad program at Chapel Hill are like wearing those on.
Yeah, exactly. It was like the white dreadlocks of Hampshire College from the 90s. But, you know, I do want to add that if anyone is curious about which Ken I am on the list, I am definitely Preppy Check Ken. Number 18, I have that exact same outfit. And in fact, if any of you want or are or identify with a Ken and would like to submit your photo looking exactly like one of the 75 Kens, Autostraddle has also started this whole like submit your photo and we'll post it alongside these Kens.
Way to make your all about be interactive, Karen.
Absolutely. Margaret, always about the people.
Margaret and I just showed up.
We're all lesbian, Ken.
This week, I am all about Sofia Coppola's The Beguiled. I watched it just a couple of hours ago. And it is this magnificent, moody, Tony work where Colin Farrell, injured Union soldier, is picked up by these women who are at a ladies' seminary in Virginia. And they, like, take back this wounded soldier and the presence of a man... just like gives you essentially an hour of women just exploring their own horniness. and the sort of like very interesting, subtle flows of dynamics between them having control over this person and wanting something out of him in the ways that he plays them. And then the reverse, it is, you know, essentially an action movie for women and overeducated gay men, by which I mean it is an inaction movie.
How much flowing white are they always wearing? Because the preview really makes it look like Picnic at Hanging Rock or something.
I mean, it really is. The number of shots...
Which is fine by me.
Like, the number of shots of curtains gently moving, so, like, that and moss are, like... I mean, moss should probably be billed above Elle Fanning in this movie. and it's interesting because there was kind of a conversation about the fact that it is a remake of a 70s movie starring Clint Eastwood. And in the original film, there was a house slave who was portrayed and sort of like as a broad comic character of sorts, but also a invocation of the fact that these women in that South were used to owning a person and having a person in their house who they controlled, and it was not something they were used to, and like relating the role of like the injured soldier to that figure,
and that informs their gaze and their subtle expressions of horniness, probably.
Absolutely. And I would say that there are a lot of interesting reversals that go on in the film, and gender hegemony and the power games that women have to play in most of society. Like, the thing is the entire movie is a twist on the game of The Handmaid's Tale, of in this situation, you own him. And it would have been very interesting to see what that movie would have been with the portrayal, like a contemplation of how race worked in that world. Sofia Coppola has said that she removed the character because she was trying to avoid problems. And it's really interesting and an interesting reflection on the culture of the way we make TV as opposed to movies, where like TV is a collective activity. So it is possible to have a number of writers in a room where somebody can create a show that has characters of color and all of that. And you can try to get the input of other people. But we do have this notion that a film like this is written by one or two people. And I think we do need to have better terms for being able to portray diversity and have sort of like voices contribute to the portrayal of that diversity. Yeah.
Yeah, or just how desire would be complicated, or the question of desire and ownership would be complicated historically by the presence of,
yeah,
you know, someone who didn't have any agency in being owned and who, you know, would be incorporated into that kind of economy of desire, but then like excluded from it and, you know, cast aside.
Well, as I understand it, like part of the criticism too is like this is a movie that specifically anchors itself in a place and time, the
yeah.
Civil War South. So if you're going to be there, why not have at least one character who's a slave? But do you feel like how much is it informed by it being the Civil War South?
Okay. Like, hugely. Like, okay. I would say that within the first 2 minutes of it, the concept of slavery is invoked. The idea that this is women, like, who are at a place learning to do woman things, learning to speak French and stitch and be women of a particular class, but also the fact that government has been removed. Mm-hmm. And so those structures that keep women enslaved and safe are also gone, and the ways that they are trying to sort of like maintain their position, but also have the temptation to move outside of their position because there's nobody there to watch them or judge them except for each other. Like, it is not just deeply set in the South, but it is deeply set in late Confederacy the South. I mean, all of those things are really beautiful, but it just strikes me. Would it have been that hard to write a draft of the script and then show it to one of your friends who is a black woman who thinks about these things and say, will you help me with this?
Well, also just that, you know, there's a kind of license to aestheticize like burgeoning white feminist feelings,
yeah,
unburdened by all of the stuff that really ends up freighting it and, you know, fracturing it in, you know, as it evolves historically. And it's sort of like, I don't know. I mean, I can see why there would be critiques about this kind of aestheticization of that, like coming into one's feminist desire, around the film.
There are interesting ways that she has explored the absence of the black class within this world, of really making it a place that is decaying because there is no one. Like, while watching it, one of the people said, why don't they sweep? And then Chris Schleicher, who has been on the show, was like, the people who sweeps left. You know, like you have entitled Elle Fanning, like half-assedly gesturing at what she thinks hoeing the weeds is. And you have moments like that that remind you through absence that like their economic pyramid has collapsed. And those things are interesting, but it would have been nice to, like, make it more explicit. And also, like, just have a contributing voice, like, you know.
Yeah, I wonder, though, too. I mean, let's be honest. I think that Sofia Coppola's biggest strength is her visual style. Like, she's an amazing stylist. Her movies look really great. I don't think she's that great with characters and
with
story.
Yeah.
And I feel like she, instead of... maybe, and I think at this point in her career, she should. Like, instead of tackling it as a challenge, she kind of just went, I'm not too good at that.
Yeah.
Like the Lost in Translation thing, too.
She's using an absence.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. And at this point, I'm kind of like, you know, you're four or five movies into a really established career. Like, you can make the risk. And let's see if next time she is going to, because she has made little sort of hints of like, yeah, I would like to try that. I would like to do that, have more people of color in my movies.
All right, you guys are listening to Pop Rocket. We're going to be back to talk about The Parable of the Sower.
I'm Hal Lublin.
I'm Danielle Radford.
I am Michael Eagle.
And we are the hosts of Tights and Fights, Maximum Fun's newest podcast dedicated to all things wrestling.
We'll be talking about Sasha Banks, the Women's Revolution, Sasha Banks, the brand split, and Sasha Banks' wigs.
And we'll also be talking about wrestler fashion. Some wrestlers wear too many clothes. Some wrestlers don't wear enough clothes at all.
And I'll be doing impressions of all your favorite wrestlers.
New episodes Thursdays on Maximum Fun or wherever you get your podcasts. Oh, yeah, dig it.
Tights and Fights Podcast. Tights and Fights.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Guy Branum. With me in the studio are...
Margaret Wappler.
And Karen Thompson.
And before we get into our main topic, I just wanted to remind you all that the Jumbotrons are officially open for Pop Rocket. Have your message read on the air by us. Just go to MaximumFun.org/Jumbotron. All right, you guys. Here's my admission. I have not read our summer reads. So I know.
Such a bad boy.
I did not do my homework. I'm sorry. I got a little overwhelmed. I read some of it, but I didn't finish it.
Well, could we just ask you really quickly, like, was there something beyond being busy, but was there something about the book itself that felt like you couldn't move through it?
Yeah, it was the fact that Amazon needed me to be there for them to deliver it to me, which meant that they, like, started, like, I didn't get it until, like, 9 days ago, and that was the primary problem. No, it was, like...
So it wasn't a stylistic...
No, I mean, it was the kind of, like, the terrible thing is I will now go and finish reading that book because it is such an interesting and ripe world, one that there's something so interesting about reading something that was written a while ago but is set in a world not too distant from our own and which, like, our world has kind of grown in that direction of, like, you know, enclosed safe spaces and, like, a
environmental catastrophe.
Yeah.
Privatization,
the whole
over.
Deal, yeah, exactly. Economic collapse.
So, tell everybody about the book, Margaret.
Parable of the Sower was written in 1993, and it is the first of a series of books. And originally, Octavia Butler envisioned there being several books in the series.
There were like six total.
Yeah, and she imagined it going from California, which is where Parable of the Sower is set, all the way to a distant planet that the Earthseed people would eventually move to and try to make a go of it elsewhere. She didn't get to that third book. That was the book she was working on when she died really young at 57, but she made several cracks at it over the years. And her archives, which are at the Huntington Library, you know, have some 40, 50 false starts that she made on this third book. But at any rate, Parable of the Sower... of all the Octavia Butler works, is probably the most mundane sci-fi, as they call it. Like, so many of her other works feature aliens, time travel, telepathy. This is really like a classic dystopian vision of, here's California. It's in the 2020s.
It's about a decade away from where we are now, because I think the Parable starts...
not even really.
Well, 2026, right? I think it ends in 2027, the novel.
But I think Parable of the Sower starts like 2023 or 4 or something like that. Not even really a decade from where we are now. And it starts in this California, in a Southern California that's really dystopian in terms of, like, there's these enclaves that are like your former subdivisions and suburbs and so forth that are now... these safe spaces in a violent world that are overrun by gangs, overrun by people that take a drug called pyro that makes them absolutely fascinated with fire and want to start fires. The political system is falling apart. It actually has a lot of Trumpian undertones, which we'll get to later. And, you know, the main character of the book is named Lauren. She's about 15 years old when we start, and she's a really unlikely protagonist because she's young, she's female, and she's black. And that was important to Octavia Butler to write herself essentially into books. She talked about that quite a bit. It's a wild ride, the book. I mean, I found it really fascinating. I actually had a hard time with it for the first like 40 pages. I found it like just a little bit slow to get into. But that might be because she starts with a dream, which I just personally am like, don't start your novel with a dream. But that's fine. I felt like once it gets going, it was gripping. Like, I couldn't put it down.
Yeah, I plowed through it in, like, 2 days. It was just, like, I couldn't stop, and I was, like, completely compelled through it, even with the interstitial poetry, right? Which Butler herself talks about writing or trying to push herself to write the sort of nascent imaginings of this Earthseed religion through a different form than what she was used to, through the, you know, like, verse versus prose, right? But it was really about the kind of tension that she established from the beginning about being, about these characters living within what is essentially a hyper-securitized gated community. It's sort of like a, almost an improvised gated community after we know, you know, in a world where
they're functioning as their own security.
Yeah, exactly.
They're
functioning as their own security. They're being held together by some of the remnant institutions like religion of the past, while essentially climate change and economic insecurity and stability collapse is and dependency on these prescription drugs that have wreaked havoc on so many people has, you know, completely eroded civil society.
Well, I wanted to bring up, too, one of the interesting things about Lauren that we should bring up is the hyper-empathic quality that she possesses, which is also a byproduct of a drug that her mother was taking that had toxic effects in the womb.
I loved the closeness of, like, her description of that. It's not a superpower. It's not telepathy. It's a bad thing that happened because my mom was a drug addict. Was a really interesting way of sort of, like, talking that down from being distancing. And I also felt in the way that Butler wrote the Earthseed religious stuff, like having religion in fantasy and sci-fi is frequent. It kind of reminded me of Dune in the way that like Dune was constantly evoking this religion that resembled our own and had chunks of our own, but was different. But I thought that it was like closer to reality than you normally get in sci-fi, and I really liked that tone of trying to remind you, this is your world. Yeah. Like, this world that she's in is your world.
Yeah, I mean, her dad's a Southern Baptist minister. Earthseed is basically built from remnants and parts of other religion, Christianity, Buddhism, like, whatever you want to name, it's part of it. And that's something that's commented on upon other characters who come to know the religion always say, oh, it kind of reminds me of this or it reminds me of that. But yeah, I mean, I think part of the reason we have Earthseed in this book and in so many dystopias is because, of course, the situation lends itself to where is God, right? Mm-hmm. Is there a God in this situation? Like, it's so horrific that you can be the biggest atheist in the world and have already made up your mind that there's no God, but you're going to at least sort of grapple with that idea in a dystopia, mm-hmm. you know, that like you are truly, it's godless.
But the one thing about the Earthseed religion that struck me is its resemblance to a kind of offshoot of Christian Science, the Science of Mind religion. And I know about this because my dad was a musical director for a church that was, you know, kind of the Center for Spiritual Living. And it was precisely about, like, the kind of God power that was transformative, that proliferated through and that acknowledged different iterations of it through multiple religions. And it was a very inward-looking one and also communitarian. And so so part of it for me was, like, this doesn't seem like a fantasized or, like, a kind of manufactured speculative religion at all. It's something that I've seen and encountered in a kind of, like, pseudo-New Agey kind of religion, but that has its roots. It was a primarily African-American church, too, that
Oh, that's
was
really
part
interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the one aspect of it that does feel the most sci-fi is her idea that the destiny of anyone that believes in Earthseed is to leave Earth and to go to another planet and eventually exist and essentially colonize some other planet. That, to me, was definitely the most sci-fi element.
Why does she think that?
I think she really thinks that, like, this world is ending as we know it. Like, it's so violent. It's so going in shambles. Like, while we're here, we're going to make the best of it. And we are going to, as much as we can, establish these tight bonds of community. But the system is crashing down on us. What can we do?
And the novel itself establishes that, you know, the forms of planetary exploration that the U.S. government at least is participating in is in part to like try to accommodate the kind of degrading planet that we're living on, right? Even
yeah.
though those missions like have been failing and there's like a kind of failed response to that. But also the part of, I think, her relationship to finding futurity on another planet is linked to that tradition of Afrofuturism, which is, you know, something that, like, from the 60s, 70s, primarily, 70s onward, of a lot of kind of African-American writers, musicians, thought about race in this kind of interplanetary way and saw a future elsewhere, right, to a destiny that could be informed by space.
Yeah, and you have to wonder if some of that is because, like, the ideas about race are so baked into this world that it almost feels like to break out of those shackles, you would just have to leave this world to, like, reclaim and re-know race entirely. Well, what did you guys think about the fact that it is set in California? And in a sense, what you're talking about with the heaven idea is really about utopia, right? That it's a utopia that exists and that maybe somewhere in California even it can be found. Is it a coincidence that this book is set in California? Could it have been set in Vermont? Could it have been set in Florida? What, like, why California?
I think that it's because California was, particularly in Butler's historical timeline, in her moment, in her coming of age, like, always stood in as this destination, as the utopia. And then part of what was always undergirded that myth was the sense of its dystopic nature, even from the early days of Sunshine and Noir.
Yeah.
Right. And so that there was always going to be the flip side to it. And there's always the promise of environmental catastrophe. Even before, let's say, 1993, when Butler is writing about this and has an extreme intelligence about climate change, more so than any, you know, one of most people of her generation had, or at least, you know, at that time
about, yeah.
and wrote about, that, you know, there was a sense that California could always fall into the ocean. You know, there could always be, you know, the big one is still coming, right? There's the earthquake, that there was always going to be something that could radically transform this landscape and turn its paradisical nature, its sunshine, into darkness, into noir, into despair, into dystopia.
Yeah, and like if you think about LA, it literally is a city that was built on a parcel of land that water is not easily accessible at all. And like whenever there was a scene where there's people gathering at a water station and filling up their bottles, I was that is very similar to any scene I've ever seen in like East Hollywood on a hot day.
I have a friend who is a comic named Alex Cole who has always insisted that San Francisco is two subway stops from the moon. That basically, as like humanity went out from like the Great Rift of Africa, like, you know, we eventually got to the west coast of California, then Hawaii, then the moon. And I do think that there is a way that California is, we can, is such a colonized place. And like also by the time people got here, like, you know, one of the great things about California is like culture and religion had sort of like fallen apart, that we didn't necessarily have some of the like tensions that people on like the East Coast and stuff have. But it also means that there is this profound lack of community. And there was something really evocative about these like gated suburban communities as like last vestige of safety.
I want to talk about some of the Trumpian undertones in the book because they are pretty ripe and pretty scary. You know, early on in the book, you hear about this presidential election that's going on. President Donner, who's running for election in the beginning, he wants to get laws changed, suspend overly restrictive minimum wage, environmental and worker protection laws for those employers willing to take on homeless employees and provide them with training and adequate room and board. So all of this is sort of built. It all sounds like a good message of like, hey, we'll give you opportunity. We'll save you. Like big daddy companies will come along and save you, which I think is like a Trump message in essence.
It is a little bit, or it's a little bit like, you know, the dismantling of the welfare system during the first Clinton administration. It's like the workfare, right?
Oh,
like
yeah.
situation that, which would have been closer to its historical moment.
Mm-hmm.
some of the influences Octavia Butler herself talked about, because like she was asked what kind of research she did for Parable of the Sower, right? And so among the things that she said she did was she, you know, I find this very charming, is she listens to like taped classes focused on religions.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so she listened to, like, she did a lot of continuing education. She never got a college degree. That's something that, you know, also this is from, you know, some, she went to Pasadena City College, and then she went to Cal State LA for a little bit. But in any case, she also brushed up on her research about guns.
Oh, yeah. I was so impressed with the gun knowledge in this book.
Yeah. So she, you know, she...
like, the NRA should know about this
book.
Yeah.
She totally, like, you know, she did that. And she tacked detailed maps of different parts of California all over her walls. She used to travel California on her Greyhound, so she, like, you know, kind of understand a little bit about that. But the other thing she did, and this to me, like, I sort of thought about this on my way over here, was, like, she listened... she said, quote, "I listened to my local national public radio and Pacifica stations and read newspapers and magazines. That wasn't so much research as my normal behavior, but because Parable of the Sower and Parable of the Talents were largely inspired by the news, by the trends that seemed important to me, the news I absorbed fed right into the novel." And so this is a kind of, it's interesting, you know, to talk about this as science fiction, as speculative fiction, but there is an element of it that is already ripped from the headlines. Right. Mm-hmm. So, and that's in the ether, that's there. And it's her actually putting together this information and speculating about what would happen if these things were brought to their logical conclusion.
Yeah, it's like she's just listening to the news and being a Cassandra in essence, and extrapolating, okay, if this is what it's like now, what would it be like in 25 years if we just keep going on this path?
Mm-hmm. Wampler, let's bring up another Cassandra. Basically, why do you think female speculative fiction writers, I'm going with Butler and I'm going with Atwood, are so much more likely to talk about the environment and how that weighs into things? Because for Atwood, for the past 20 years, her obsession has been like how decay of our environmental situation is going to affect everybody, but also affect women. I mean, that's Handmaid's Tale, but it's also... you know, Oryx and Crake, and, you know, The Heart Goes On. The Heart Goes Last.
That's a good question. I mean, some of it, I mean, just off the top of my head, I feel like some of it has to do with, like, a sort of domestic space, right? Like, what comes into your domestic space from the environment is polluted food, polluted water, these things that are, in essence, part of, like, the domestic everyday sphere. And I think, you know, I mean, there are research and studies done about how, like, autoimmune diseases, for instance, like, hit women disproportionately more than men, which gets tied to chemicals in our food and water and all that kind of thing. And so I think Atwood and Butler were just really tuned into, and part of it is, like, California and Canada, you know, where they are, like, these vast refuges of beautiful land, and, like, what, you know, being
seeing them ravaged over the course of various years.
And, like, seeing it happen constantly in your purview.
So I think one of the other reasons, perhaps, that female writers like Atwood, like Butler, kind of tackle the relationship between the environment, the body, et cetera, and one of the other things in common, too, is that they also tackle the sense of how drugs... prescription drugs, not illicit, illegal drugs, but these drugs that are overprescribed that become the kind of panaceas for various ailments, end up becoming more destructive in the long run than things that are sort of illicit or recreational. They're the things that are supposed to cure and ail. And I think that there's a relationship between women and health where women are overprescribed things. We can kind of link it to vaxxing, anti-vaxxing, the whole debate about that.
Yeah,
but
or even
also
something
like antidepressants, or like things that are supposed to, you know, her mother, Parasito, I think is the drug, right, that her mother was addicted to that led to her hyperempathy, Lauren's hyperempathy. That was supposed to be an early treatment to Alzheimer's, right? And so I don't know. I think that there's something about that relationship. I mean, you look at any prescription drug ad on TV and it's like ladies washing dishes and, you know, being out in the lawn or whatever.
Well, yeah, and you think about how like half of the medications that were prescribed for various heart ailments were never even tested on women.
Yeah.
Ever. You know,
yeah.
They were just assumed if it works for a guy, you know, give it to the woman. And yeah. Now we know that like women have completely different symptoms of heart attacks and all these other things.
Margaret, they didn't test it on women. They tested it on people. It says it on people.
Right.
They were people.
Wait, can I read this one thing that just to continue, to go back to the Trump.
Trumpian overtones.
Yeah, I really want to credit Ellen Middaugh, who wrote me a note on Twitter pointing out that in Parable of the Talents, which is the follow-up book to Parable of the Sower, Octavia Butler gives us Senator Andrew Steele Jarrett, who's basically a violent autocrat in the year 2032. His supporters are known to form mobs. His political opponent at one point calls him a demagogue, a rabble-rouser, and a hypocrite. And then this is the most prescient and absolutely freaky. Jarrett rallies his crowd with the call to make America great again.
Yeah.
No.
Oh, yes. It's all over that. Actually, my wife Sarah just posted this the other day because we were kind of both reading Parable of the Talents again.
Yeah.
And we're just like, oh, in the first 100 pages of that novel, Make America Great Again, and these like Christian mobs that run around like basically burning up, you know, pot dealers. And
she was
like
thinking of Pat Robertson, apparently, or like somebody like that. But, you know, yeah.
Butler also wrote in the 70s the book Kindred about a woman who is trans, a black woman in Los Angeles who is transported back in time to save her white ancestor on a plantation in Maryland. She has a lot of books that are very, like, they've sold well, they're very well respected, but not things that have ever been made to into TV or movies, come close to making it into the TV or movies. Does it just come down to we barely make movies that star black women, and or is it something, are there more complex reasons for why we haven't seen her stuff get adapted?
I do think it might just be a matter of time now, but I know her Dawn series, for instance, was optioned. You know, a couple years ago, there was several articles about that being turned into a TV series. But I, you know, I just Googled it before we met and I couldn't find anything recent.
Yeah.
So maybe it's died in the water. Maybe not.
A lot of things have been optioned but never made.
Yeah.
And I think that people recognize that these stories should be made. I think that, you know, like especially in the Handmaid's Tale, like Hulu for your consideration moment.
Yes.
It like makes
look on my way
sense.
Here. I
yeah.
did figure out who was adapting Brave New World. I was like, somebody's got to be adapting Brave New World.
Yeah,
it's like Sci-Fi Channel.
Well, yeah, I mean, so exactly, all of these things are being adapted. All of these things are being made. I would hope it's a matter of time, but I do think that one of the, you know, quote unquote, quote prohibitive aspects of this is, you know, staffing a very multicultural, primarily African American, but also like Parable of the Sower. It's a deeply diverse text. Like, the people who she begins to travel with on the road are of many different races and mixed race. And I think that, like, you know, they're like, oh, this is a great story. But then it hits that point where they're like, oh, let's think about casting. Let's think about, you know, like, how to make this a viable production. And I think it hits that roadblock, frankly.
Well, like many times in the past, I've thought about Kindred and like, why isn't this a movie? And it basically comes down to Zoe Saldana has to really, really want to make Kindred for Kindred to get made, or else
it's probably true that like an actress has to hook herself onto it.
And one, I mean, there, like, we've got a black actress currently who kind of has the juice in this town to maybe get something like this made. And also, these are stories that are like, Octavia Butler was a good enough writer to make things complex and not simple or easy. And there are ways that white producers are willing to give their money to a nice, clean story. Like, what was the math movie called?
Hidden Figures.
Hidden Figures. And it was a great movie, but it was also clean. Like, it,
yes,
was,
it was
clean and Kevin, what's his name, like, knocked down that sign, and there was a white person who was good, and all of the black people were so noble as to be above reproach. And Octavia Butler doesn't give you that kind of cleanliness.
I also wonder if Kindred isn't hampered in a way by its sci-fi elements. Like, if it was just a slave narrative without the time travel essence, would it be made?
Because I feel that forces us to think about what would an actual human being like what would a black woman like you know do reacting to this, instead of having the sort of like objectified figures that we get in slave narratives, you know?
Yeah, I mean, and I do feel like in a way, like, people go, there's a certain cadre of people that go to see slave narratives so they can sit there and work out their white guilt and felt like they've paid their penance for the time of that movie and that they get to walk out. And if it's freaky and weird and Afrofuturistic and involves time travel, it, like, contorts that whole process. And then it just turns into something that
there are some Afrofuturist elements to Get Out, like the So I mean, I suppose that if it's sort of,
but it's still like in our time.
If it's cloaked by a narrative about hypnosis and psychoanalysis, it's okay.
So on our Facebook group, Al Rich commented that, oddly, one of the parts of this book that I found the most heartbreaking was the loss of the bond between people and dogs. What can I say? I'm a crazy dog person. I'm totally with you on that, Al. I think that's a really disturbing element. It reminds me of The Leftovers, too, because The Leftovers also has a similar plot structure around dogs, where, like, one of the first ways you know that this world is messed up is that the dogs won't trust humans anymore. So in Parable of the Sower, you see that the dogs they're all feral. I mean, they basically attack humans as much as any scavenger does.
And the only person who has any faith in dogs is Bankole. Is that how you pronounce his name?
Bankole?
I'm not sure.
I like that you give him a little French twist.
I mean, is it like it's supposed to, anyway, whatever. I'll say Bankole. I'll pronounce all of it. But that he's the only one who, like, brings up the possibility of getting a couple of dogs and then making them guard dogs and domesticating later on at near the end of the book. I actually spoke to a friend who is a Butler scholar about the dog stuff, and she, not being a pet person, but also for many other reasons, said, like, you know, that I think that one of the things that we can take away from the book around this is about the analogs between the kind of domestication of people in slavery and the domestication of dogs, and that, like, part of what's happening here is that kind of analog of, like, people and dogs, particularly people of color and dogs, having to, like, break these forms of domestication that they've been conditioned in and, like, survive and learn how to survive. And so I thought that was an interesting point.
Yeah, I mean, another one of the book's most disturbing moments is when we stumble upon a little camp of cannibal children.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that has to be one of the most hardcore scenes in the book.
Yeah.
And I think that's another sign when systems break down that we can normally trust, you know, that children are benevolent, that children are never going to do something like that, that's when you know the world is in, like, an absolute state of decay.
But they're only scavengers.
I want to bring up what Laura Darling talked about, and I want to thank Laura Darling too for getting a conversation started on Goodreads about the book. And if you guys aren't part of the Goodreads Pop Rocket group, you should go and join that. Laura Darling says, "I'm an Episcopal priest, and I actually found the religion quite fascinating, and the notion of a founder of a religion building off of and out from the religion in which she was raised made a great deal of sense. There's a way in which the entire book circles/focuses around the question, who is God and where is God and how do I connect with God? And it answers those questions in very intriguing ways. What did you think of the religious aspects of the book?" We talked about this a little bit, but I still want to just ask you guys, would you follow Lauren if you were in this world?
I think I'm ready to, like, figure out an Earthseed situation, or at least, right? Or be where we are at the end of the book and, like, start Acorn.
Yeah.
You know, because, I mean, I think given how depressing the news is every day, and given, like, how I feel like we're careening towards some form of, like, unlivable world. And I'm like, at least I want to take the elements of Ritzy that are like, I need to learn how to plant shit that will grow in arid climates. I need to learn some survival skills, like how to get water when there's no water to be found. And, like, I think that those survivalist elements of it seem incredibly pragmatic in the world we're in.
Yeah, I mean, I do think one of the appealing factors about Earthseed is really just that it's survivalist, you know, mm-hmm. how survivalist it is. Like, don't just wait for the world to crash around you. Have these skills that will help you survive in it. And I think we got, like, we all got, like, a little taste of that when the drought was in full force.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
totally.
It was like, oh, you know, maybe I should at least know what the drought-resistant plants are so I can plant those in my yard and that kind of thing.
I'm just deeply skeptical of a religion founded by anyone during recorded history. Like, I like things to be at the very edges of recorded history. And I, my mind goes to a video that Phoebe Robinson and Jessica Williams made about Kwanzaa, and basically saying, like, the only reason you doubt Kwanzaa is because it was made by a dude in the 60s. Like, if your friend
so true.
If your friend pitched Hanukkah to you, you'd be like, shut the fuck up. and I do think fundamentally I would not end up being a Lauren follower just because I like old tested modes of thought.
And I think she gets a lot of that flack in the book from various characters being kind of like, who are you to make up a religion? Like, it has to be the ancient man stumbling through the desert that makes up the religion.
Says the teenage girl.
Yeah.
Stumbling on the 101.
I mean, I like that it's a teenage girl. I wish more people were trying to sell me goddesses. like, American Gods, like, makes a hard sell for Bilquis, the Queen of Sheba, as a sex goddess. And
nice.
I would follow that religion. All right, you guys. You're listening to Pop Rocket. Let us know what you thought of The Parable of the Sower. And unfortunately, I'm sorry about this, but at some point in time in a couple of months, my all about will be, so I finally read this book and I'm now making Margaret and Karen talk to me about it. And Margaret will be nice and Karen will be a university professor about this, where she will humor me, but be angry I did not do the reading when it was assigned.
Always
we'll
do
subtly
the reading.
Shade you. It's okay.
Yeah. We'll be right back.
What the f- is an interview? I mean, I do not know.
That was Oscar-winning filmmaker Errol Morris. I'm Jesse Thorne, host of NPR's Bullseye. Allow me to introduce The Turnaround, a new podcast series produced by MaximumFun.org and presented with the Columbia Journalism Review. Join me as I sit down with some of our greatest living interviewers to ask them about interviewing and why and how they do what they do. We'll go deep with some of the biggest names in media, people like Larry King, Katie Couric, Audie Cornish. We'll be among friends on The Turnaround. 2 episodes a week, all summer. Subscribe now and tell somebody.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Guy Branum. With me in the studio are
Margaret Wappler
and Karen Tongson.
Now, Karen, every week we ask our panel, what's your current jam? And you probably think I came unprepared for that as well, but I'm not. I am prepared to ask the question, Karen Tongson, what is your current jam?
This is a very oblique jam vis-a-vis Parable of the Sower, but it got me thinking about the time period in which Parable of the Sower was written in the early 90s. And so my jam is SWV's Right Here.
We all need to be in backwards overalls right the fuck now.
Right? I mean, I just rewatched the music video, and there's like at one point where they're all like kind of, it looks like some Puerto Rican ruins, and they're wearing pirate shirts tucked into really tight like chinos tucked into like riding boots, and then they're riding in like kind of like probably backward denim overalls on horses next to the beach. So, I mean, so this is SWV's Human Nature remix of Right Here. It was their first single in the summer of 1992, the first summer after my first year in college. So I was feeling really frisky and pirate shirted at the time myself. And the remix is actually by Teddy Riley, who's credited with the creation of New Jack Swing. he worked with Michael Jackson, Bobby Brown, Usher, Keith Sweat, Blackstreet. And, you know, so you can kind of hear that influence in this song. But it's just such a delight. And it also has a Survivor tie-in.
Thank you, Karen.
It's a guy here. you know, good old Taj, one of the best players,
was
I think.
Was that Gabon?
In all seasons of Survivor. Was it Gabon? I can't really remember. She was in multiple seasons is the thing.
No, I don't think that...
She played an All-Star season, too.
Because I always thought the thing with Taj, because Taj was like a really, really great player who was, I mean... One of the things that they have the greatest difficulty figuring out on Survivor is that, like, a somewhat Zoftig woman in her 40s can be really, really good at a lot of those challenges. But she always had this light air of, I was a pop star and my husband was in the NFL. I kind of care what's going on here.
Yeah. But she was definitely in an All-Star season. I will tell you that.
Okay.
Okay.
I still haven't finished my
grand Survivor catch-up.
Yes. Let's be clear. I did not read The Parable of the Sower, but I have watched over 20 seasons of Survivor in the past month and a half.
Hashtag priorities.
Margaret Wapler, what's your current jam?
My current jam is from The Magic Numbers. It's actually an older album. It's 2005, their self-titled debut. And I don't know, this is just capturing my mood. It actually sounds, I didn't realize this until later, but it sounds a lot like the Imperial Teen song I played last week. But now you know that this is just the kind of energy that I'm running with. Like, I'm into the summer bounce right now. So this is Love Me Like You from The Magic Numbers. Interesting things about this band is that it's made of one brother and sister combo and another brother and sister combo. Ooh. And they also have the distinction of walking off, being one of the few bands, maybe the only band, that walked off of Top of the Pops because the host made a kind of jab at their collective weight.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. They're heavy set, and he said, like, it's a big, fat, melting pot of talent with the magic numbers. And they were like, peace out, bye. So good for them for making a stance.
You do have seasonal music taste because you're into the summer bop, like, and we had, like, the sort of winter,
Yeah.
I work with the seasons, guys.
I also think this baby is just fun, and I think,
it's true.
You know, it's filling Margaret with fun. You guys, this past week, the Mindy Writers Room went to Las Vegas for our seasonal retreat. And when in Las Vegas, you go to an artist who is doing a residency. And what kind of artists do residencies? Why divas do residencies? Mm. Let's listen to a diva.
We're firing the t-shirt cannons now.
The diva in question was, of course, Ricky Martin. And it was wonderful because Mindy got...
I was going to say, that sounds like a Devo. Excuse me.
Like, Mindy going into it was very much like, is this going to be fun? Like, is this going to be... and Chris Schleicher and I were both like, yes, and hoping. But the thing is like, he fucking brought it. He fucking brought it and delivered Live in La Vida Loca within the first 5 minutes, and you knew he was holding on to Cup of Life for the finale. And it was like, it was very much a Vegas show where there isn't an encore. We all know what's going to go on for this hour and 20 minutes, but it's like everything you want. And like, he sold it so hard. And Ricky Martin is magical. That is a face that has had no Botox and no fillers because he's gotten to fuck anyone he wants to for the entirety of his life. So when you're in that situation, like, he's just such a magnificent sexual persona. And I must ask you, as these, like, waning days of Pride Month go down, Karen Tongson, why is it that we as a community, like, lesbians, I feel like, are good at loving they're lesbian icons. And I feel like gay guys do not know what the fuck to do. Like, we love, like, Crystal Waters fucking works every goddamn pride. Cece Peniston is in Indianapolis right now.
Absolutely.
But, like, the Ricky Martin, we treat like it's such an arm's length relationship with this person. And one of the really fun things was, like, I've never seen him perform untethered from the responsibilities of the closet. And he was, you know, like, pretending to mess around with dudes and ladies. And there was one moment when he was in a very 2003 outfit and he sort of like grabbed for his cock with a like magnificent width to his hand. And it was like, oh, this Ricky Martin. And I ask you,
it's like Adam Lambert, like in that Idol perform or like that, or his first Grammy performance was really trying to channel Ricky Martin's, you know, big Grammy breakthrough. When he did, I guess it was like, you know, She Bangs or something like that.
It was The Cup of Life. It was 1998, and it changed all of us. Yeah. It was an amazing performance.
I mean, I think that the words Margaret used in the beginning, it's Devo versus Diva, yeah, right? And I think that there's a way in which, like, you know, you can project your fantasy onto these, like, female stars and starlets. There's always been this storied relationship between gay men and these women kind of on pedestals or in these celestial atmospheres. Whereas, you know, your Ricky Martins of the world are just, you know, they're going to be mirrors in a certain way. Well, you're going to be like scared of what he looks like when he ages and, you know, things like that.
But also, mirroring really is the issue. Like, that like women are these funhouse mirrors where things are distanced enough that we can look at ourselves in it and the differences are fun and funny. But when you look at a Ricky Martin, you're just like, oh, he's more attractive than I am.
So it like just pisses you off.
Yeah, it just pisses you off.
Yeah, it can piss you off, or it can, you know, or you can feel sad for him because you're younger than he is and he's like, you know, looking a little older.
I mean, he looks real good, though.
He looks
real good.
Does.
And also, how much he let himself just be sweaty on that stage was like, oh, you magnificent beast. You have been listening to Pop Rocket. Oh, also, I need to say, the sheer number of Puerto Rican flags in that audience,
oh, yeah,
were electrifying. And then when the Puerto Rican flag came up in his like video presentations, like 10% of the audience went apeshit. And it was the best. You've been listening to Pop Rocket, hosted by me, Guy Branum, with Margaret Wappler, Karen Tongson, and an unnamed person lodged somewhere in Margaret. We're talking about this now, right?
Yes. We haven't for
okay.
a while.
Yeah. Our theme music is Party Booby Trap by Ozzy Mizo. Thanks to him for letting us use it. Thanks to Ryko516 for the 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. If you haven't already, please review us. Over 900 other people have done it. I don't know what you're waiting for. Get in touch with us on Twitter. We're at Pop Rocket, or join our Facebook group and get in the discussion. We are a production of MaximumFun.org. And our producers are Carol Hart and the Tindered Christian Duenas.
All right.
Is that okay?
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.